Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 189th video cast, 179th podcast for the week ending June 1st, 2023. We're going to make this one quicker than normal with the shortened week. And with Alibaba starting to rebound, we don't have as much to talk about anymore. But, you know, it's funny. Today, Alibaba was up 4.5% or 5%. But think about that in real terms. Between yesterday, when there was utter despondency, or the day before, and today, the market is telling us that Alibaba is worth $9 to $10 billion more today than it was yesterday. And that's just silly season. It's as silly as Alibaba trading at $130 billion net of cash when 2 years ago, when the financials weren't any better, it was trading at $750 billion. So it just goes to show the difference between despondency and euphoria. And when we look at these price movements, we make so much meaning as to what they mean. And fundamentally, you just have to know what you own, know what it's intrinsically worth, i.e. a lot more than today. We've done the sum of the parts in the last recent weeks. But, you know, look at the silliness of how the market assigns pricing. As a matter of fact, chatting with a really good friend of mine who was in Singapore this week, and sentiment is so low. There were Chinese managers in Singapore looking for Japanese proxies who have business in China to buy the Japanese stock so they could benefit from the Chinese recovery without owning a Chinese stock, because sentiment is so low on China right now. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You know, the last thing a Chinese manager wants to do is buy a Japanese stock, but they're looking at them so that they could find a backdoor way to benefit from the massive Chinese growth, because no one wants to own Chinese stocks. And that tells you all you need to know where pessimism is on the spectrum and why one company can grow $9 billion in one day with no announcements whatsoever. Silly season, the end of the despondency, and the beginning of the recovery, and that's where we are. So, quick media, want to thank Akash Sriram and Samrita Arunsalam for including me in their article on Reuters this week, as well as Sriyashi Sinyal for including me in her article. A couple quick Twitter things. I thought this was great from Marcel Munch, who I've been on his great podcast, East West Investments. And he said, another CIO surprised on the ground in China. So here's the chief investment officer from, I looked him up, it's some major firm. But, okay, so he says, wow, China is open. You have to see it to believe it. In Shanghai, this is from yesterday, 6 hours ago. Restaurants are bustling, new EVs are everywhere, and JP Morgan just hosted their largest China conference ever with over 3,000 investors attending. Tim Zhang and I are meeting with many companies over this week. First thing that you notice being back in China is the 180-degree opening. Entry into the country was seamless. No one mentions COVID, and few people even wear masks. Wait a second. I thought 65 million people a week are getting COVID, but when you actually go there, apparently that's not the case. People are busy at malls, restaurants are back at work, new technologies are booming, 30% of cars sold last year in China were EVs, the largest EV market in the world now, and you see EVs everywhere, not just Tesla, new models from BYD, XPeng, Li Auto, NIO, fill the roads, looks like a glimpse of what roads will look like in the US in 3 to 5 years. Also a lot of excitement around Chinese development of AI, solar, robotics, and companies like Bristol Myers, L'Oreal, Bain, and others. Highlighted companies are doubling down on China as their largest offshore R&D hub. Recovery is happening, but still lacks confidence after years of COVID, geopolitics, property market weakness, lower stock markets, and policy uncertainty. Consumers are still tentative, and private investment has been slow to come back, but 6% GDP growth in 2023, this year, is still attainable. Geopolitical tensions are the big question, but some positive gains. I was encouraged to hear some positive dialogue presentations by Henry Kissinger, Condoleezza Rice, Zhu Min, Jake Sullivan, Huang Yiping, and Jamie Dimon, all pointing to the fact that dialogue is happening again and that in the end, collaboration is in everyone's best interest, but there's definitely still de-risking on both sides. Overall, With still much misconception about China from the outside, it is good to see what things are really like on the ground. We should just stop the podcast there this week because that's all you really need to know. Great account there. This is from Seth Golden saying, quote, the Fed has everything it needs to pause. We covered that in the article of the week. But he goes through manufacturing, PMI, new orders, production, employment, supplier deliveries, inventories, consumer inventories, and the trends and the duration of the trends, and it gives them more than enough cover. Here's from Ryan Dietrich, another positive for June. Years that gain greater than 5% in January tend to see consolidation most of May and early June before a nice surge higher into July. So that's what we had in May and June, and now it looks like we'll have a big summer surge moving forward. And that was, you don't even need this history to know. All you needed to look at was money markets, $6.6 trillion, everyone in cash and T-bills waiting for the 20% drop so they can buy on the cheap. And when everyone's waiting, the market is never going to give it to the common folk that are crowded on one side of the boat. It just doesn't work that way. So communicate, these are bullish percent. These are percentage of companies on a point and figure buy signal. We don't use point and figure, but we do like to look at this metric to get a sense of the different sectors. Communication services is kind of in this middle range. We're looking for the things that are down for the biggest opportunity going forward. So even if you look at NASDAQ Composite, as much as it's run, it still really has a lot to do here. When you get beyond the FANG stocks and a couple of the semiconductors, there's so much under the surface still left to be done. Looks a lot like 2015 and 16 for sure. Then you've got consumer discretionary, kind of middle of the range. Energy is towards the lower end of the range. I still don't have a lot of stuff there that I want to pound the table by. If you look at the integrateds, they haven't come down much, even though crude has come down quite a lot. Again, if I was forced to put more money to work, I'd be looking at some of the natural gas players like Comstock and range has moved again. I think it's back up close to $30. But some of those, maybe Southwest Energy, I'd have to get comfortable with their balance sheet, but maybe financials are down towards the bottom of the range. I think now we're kind of at the point where we want to have some exposure. A few weeks ago, we talked about the KRE trade that we have out to 2025. We think that is going to be a small multi-bagger, like 2 or 3X, based on the in-the-money options. So there's opportunities there. Gold could care less. Healthcare, this is towards the range where you want to start to look at stuff. As a matter of fact, some of the insurers started to get bid. We're most interested in biotech, which is kind of separate from this. Dow, bottom end of the range. So as much as you see all the indices breaking out to new highs, most of the stocks are towards the lows where there's still enormous amounts of opportunity. So don't feel like you missed anything if you're just looking at the indices. Industrial, same thing, a lot of opportunities there. Infotech, which probably has the FANG as some of the top weights in there, like Microsoft, let's say, like Alphabet, they're towards the top end of the range. They're probably going to take a breather here, is my guess, in June, and other stuff are going to start to pick up, and we'll talk about that in the article. NYSE stocks are probably going to start to get bid. And then finally, real estate, bottom end of the range, had a little bounce, but they're just getting started, and we're going to talk about why we think those are going to continue to recover in a major way towards the back half of the year. Telecom, transports, opportunity, utilities, if you're into that, some opportunity. Then you take a look at the ratio charts. If you look at like these different groups, this is value to growth has taken a breather. I think value could probably start to get a bit over the summer, some aspects of it. Certainly small caps have underperformed relative to the S&P 500. These are all relative to the S&P 500. I think this is going to reverse, and we're going to talk about why. So I think small caps is a huge opportunity. As many of you know, for small caps to work, number one, regional banks have to work, and number two, energy to a lesser extent has to start to get a little bit of bid, stop falling, and I think both of those things are going to happen. Bonds to stocks have been dramatically underperforming. I think you're going to see a bid on the longer end, and we'll talk about why. This is Asher, which is China A shares relative to the S&P. I think this is at a bottom. I think you're going to start to see massive relative outperformance. We'll talk about why. Same with emerging markets. It's the same exact chart as China's 38% of emerging markets. Equal weight to the regular S&P has dramatically underperformed. I think this now has to start to get bid where equal weight starts to perform, and some of those heavyweights maybe perform less well relative to some of the rest that have been left behind. That's China, same story as EEM. Biotech, same thing. I think that's bottoming out here and starting to turn around. Defense stocks, same thing. Came down hard on the fear of the debt ceiling. Now that's going to start to go up. Real estate, one of the most oversold relative to the S&P. I think it's time. No one feels that way. That's why I like it. KWEB, same story. OIH is oil services. There may be, that may be another area besides the natural gas companies like the National Oil Well, Varco's. I haven't looked at Schlumberger in a while. Those type of companies might be worth a look. Here's the XBI relative to the S&P. Made that bottom last May. Been going sideways for 12 months. I think that thing's ready to go, and we'll touch on that in the article of the week. Materials, there may be some things to do here. I'm not a huge fan of that group, but I think there may be some things to do there. Communication services have been doing well. That'll probably persist maybe at a slower pace in the short term. Here are the big energy companies. They've come back a little bit, but not quite as much as I would love. Financials, yes, I think that's interesting. Industrials, I think there's opportunity there now. Look at tech relative to that. Remember, we were pounding the table in October on semis and tech when everyone hated it. That thing's gone parabolic. Staples have come back. They're still a little expensive, but there might be some discrete opportunities there. Utilities, certainly, I think they'll get a bounce here as the long end gets bid. We'll talk about that. Healthcare, we did that. Discretionary, they've been outperforming. I think they'll continue to go up, but at a relatively slower pace in the next few months. Some of these other things are going to play catch up. XOP is more the stuff you'd find in the small cap. I think that's ready to get a little bit of bid. And then retail has been left for dead. I think there are some unique opportunities there with some of these big sell-offs and some of the retail names in recent weeks. I think there's opportunity. Moving forward to some of the articles of the week. Pressure mounts for U.S. response after China's Micron bid. So the headlines have just been nonstop nonsense, but if you get to the substance of the story, there's actually a lot of positive thing where both sides were saying, both sides were saying that the talks went well. Let's see. It's hard to find because they have an agenda in what they're trying to write. Well, anyway, they might have even edited the story. But leaving that aside, here's the another version. Candid talks. China and U.S. trade officials vow to step up communication and manage tensions. So that was after the U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo met with Chinese Commerce Minister Wang Wentao. And China describes talk between the China Commerce Minister Wang and Raimondo as professional and constructive, et cetera, et cetera. So they're still, you know, going back and forth about Micron and everything else, but they'll get that worked out. Shanghai gears up for post-COVID tourism boom as Disneyland raises ticket prices. You don't raise ticket prices when there's no demand. That is going to rock and roll. They're raising prices by 10%. People forget that, believe it or not, Disney's a bigger company than, you know, a few hundred acres in Orlando, Florida. And that game has been basically shut off for 3 years, and now it's going to come rip-roaring back. No one's positioned for it. We are. We'll take advantage. China's disappointing rebound could bring in more stimulus, economists say. So, bad news, good news. Look, I think you just, you know, the country's been open for a few months. The patient was on life support. It's walking around the hospital with the rolling stick. Let him put his clothes back on and walk around the parking lot before you get him on the track. And I think that's where we are, and I think it's going to be fine. But I do think this is a positive because there will be pressure for them to cut the reserve requirement ratio and maybe add a little more stimulus just as things are getting going. Like you saw the on-the-ground account from that chief investment officer in Shanghai. So a lot of good things happening. China calls for stable ties with U.S. in meeting with Elon Musk. Key is the dialogue is happening. Jamie Dimon is over there for the first time in 3 years. Elon Musk is over there for the first time in 3 years, and more will follow. Bernard Arnault is going over. And as these major power players go and talk with the Chinese government, you're going to start to see more intermediary communication and pressure from companies with the U.S. government, pressure from companies with the Chinese government to start to ease things up a little bit, if so long as the governments actually like having jobs among their populace, and I think it'll be a good thing. Economists trim China growth forecasts, expect reserve requirement ratio cut sooner, so that would be a positive growth driver for sure. Alibaba and JD kick off this year's June 18th festival amid company reshuffles and stronger consumer spending in China. So the big deal here is the initial numbers are very strong. This is the second biggest retail festival of the year besides Single Day, so we're going to get a boost from that. This is from AQR, Cliff Asness, down here in Greenwich. He is talking about the relative outperformance of the U.S. to international stocks from 1994 to 2023, and how history shows that that outperformance won't sustain. And he's saying, he's making the case that either the U.S. is going to go into a recession, which is going to allow international stocks to outperform, or China's reopening after the pandemic is going to make China's outperformance so material relative to the U.S. that that's going to be the cause for the outperformance. And we are in the latter camp. So we'll see how that plays. Alibaba forges new pact to deepen collaboration with northern China's Tianjin in AI, cloud computing, and big data initiatives. So that game continues to go forward. AI, Alibaba to build ChatGPT-like AI into meeting and messaging apps. Here's the guy who's now on the... Chris Davis, he's a money manager. $20 billion. He's now on the Berkshire Hathaway board. He's getting bullish on banks. So that's important. Intel has had a turnaround this week. Last week, NVIDIA was up and Intel was down. Now NVIDIA's up. Now NVIDIA stopped going up and Intel's on starting to get bid. And that's because Jensen Huang says... Intel's test chips look good for their new high quality chips. And I think the thing that people forget about NVIDIA is they don't produce anything, they design it. So there's only one game in town right now, which is Taiwan Semi, and the second game in town that will produce their chips is going to be Intel. So if you're bullish on NVIDIA, you should be more bullish on Intel, because you're going to get the benefit of NVIDIA's growth through Intel in coming years, but the difference is the valuation you're buying it at today. And I think that's just a monster thing to keep in mind. And I think the market is starting to sniff that out. And Jensen is being really smart in hedging his bets with Taiwan Semi, because he knows that Gelsinger's fabs are going to be able to produce whatever chips he wants, and he will be beholden to Intel and beholden to Taiwan Semiconductor to get his stuff done, and they'll be happy to do it for him. So I think it's a win-win-win all the way around. Here's an article saying what I've been saying, that U.S. dollar is overbought and could weaken to recent lows as the next Fed meeting looms. Part of my thesis was the end of the debt ceiling. There was a bid to safety. That's now going to unwind in coming days, and then the final shoe to drop will be the inflation numbers on Tuesday, June 13th, followed by the Fed pause, or as they're calling it right now, skip, on June 14th, and then the dollar should reverse lower, which will, or continue its downtrend from October, which had been a counter trend rally in the last 4 weeks, which hurt emerging markets in China. As the dollar weakens, emerging markets in China will be back in the game. Goldman put this out, a list of 51 beaten down stocks that will outperform if the U.S. avoids a recession. I think this is pretty interesting because if you were to take these 50 stocks and you just put 2% in each versus the S&P over the next 3 years, I think this would probably outperform by 4 to 5 percentage points. So if the S&P did, 12% a year for the next 2 years to play catch up, this would probably do 15 to 17%. And I don't like all these names, but I like enough of them that, it starts to, make sense. You got Pool Corp here. Is this Ralph? No, that's Restoration Hardware. Don't like that one. VF Corp, Mohawk, Capri got battered today. So some of these that are getting battered, Airbnb maybe, I don't know. Choice Hotels, PayPal we like. Block we don't really like, but it's down enough. It could, in a basket, it doesn't matter if you're doing 2% per position. But there's a lot here. Some of these financials that have been Capital One, F-Fidelity Information Services, Global Payments, all these have been, decimated. Franklin Resources, they'll go up as AUM goes up because the market goes up. Synchrony. So you have a lot of these subprime lenders that are down a lot. They're certainly going to take the write-downs, but I think the markets have more than priced most of the write-downs they're going to take. Same with Invesco. Assets go up. Starwood Property Trust. So they're really, 3M, we like that. So they're really scraping the bottom of the barrel here for the most beaten down stocks. And I think enough of them are interesting that it was a worthwhile article. We obviously don't want to be in 50 stocks. We're in about 10 or 12. And that's the way you do it with concentration. PayPal's finally getting some love. The stock pops at Mizuno, says pricing concerns largely overblown, buy on weakness. And they put a $92 per share price target on that. So that would be up 50%, almost 50%. I think that's underestimating it, looking out a little bit more than, but that's a 12-month price target. So that's probably realistic. Intel shares jump as chipmaker sees second quarter revenue at the upper end of the outlook, which confirms our thesis that the inventory destocking, we hit peak inventories in Q1. We've been saying that for many podcasts. Intel could find a lifeline in NVIDIA. We've covered that. And skipper flip stock market and sentiment results. Here's our article of the week. This was the biggest news out on Wednesday was two FOMC members making their case for no hike in June. This language and timing is no accident. After 500 basis points of 10 consecutive hikes, the effective Fed funds rate is at 5.08%. Of note, core PCE, the Fed's favorite inflation gauge, is now below 5%. And historically, this is when the Fed stops hiking. When the Fed funds rate is above the rate of inflation is when the Fed stops hiking. This would give them time to collect more data and determine whether future hikes would be necessary, or if they would be able to turn the skip into a pause. That's our base case. On Wednesday evening, the Fed whisperer at the Wall Street Journal, Nick Timiraos, confirm that stance. This was the article you can see. Fed prepares to skip June rate. Okay. As we have stated since January in our podcast video cast, the key inflation months were going to be May, June, and July. This is when inflation would, quote, fall off a cliff. Those of you who have been listening know that. Due to base effects of owner's equivalent rents, major weighting in the CPI, I think it's like 38%, if I'm not mistaken, and the 12-month lag on leases. It would not surprise us to see a 3-handle on headline inflation on the next print. We get the first of these numbers, the May numbers, on Tuesday, June 13th. So this will be the first of the 3-month series where we said this is when inflation was going to fall off a cliff. We're going to find out how that works out. The Fed makes its rate decision on Wednesday, June 14th, the day after. Even European inflation is starting to cool. We saw overnight fell to 6.1% for their May numbers from 7% in their April numbers, and that was below 6.3% predicted, and their core inflation was 5.3 from 5.6. The year-on-year, Germany's dropped on its year-on-year from 7.2 to 6.1. Spain dropped from 4.1 to 3.2, and France from 6.9 to 6. So Fed Governor Jefferson wanted to be explicit that a skip was not a pause, but the inflation, as the inflation numbers roll over, we believe the June skip will in fact become a pause through the end of the year. We're not in the cuts camp. We do think there could be one or two cuts in early 2024, and that's it. Kind of like a 1995 analog where they stopped hiking and then they cut one or two times. And I think they then raised once and then they kind of kept it there at about 6% from 95 to 2000. And everyone said, well, tech can't work when, you know, Fed funds rate is over 5%. Well, it worked pretty damn well from 95 to 99 when the Fed funds rate was over 6%. So that's all you need to know there. The market responded to the words of Harker and Jefferson's comments, and the odds of a June hike immediately flipped, went from 70% a day and a half ago to 35% after they spoke. I haven't looked at it today. Now, this is the most important part of the podcast this week. These following lines. We are at the cusp of a major sea change, and the knock-on effects will be material. We expect to see two meaningful changes in coming months as a result of the Fed being done. Number one, the dollar will resume its downtrend after a debt ceiling safe haven bid we've seen in recent weeks. That was right here. So this is over in our view. The most directly impacted asset class from this development will be the groups that have been left behind in the recent rally. First, emerging markets in China will resume the uptrend they began in October. China trades inversely with the US dollar and is the heaviest weighting in the emerging markets indices. So, here was the peak of the dollar in October. Here was the bottom of emerging markets and Alibaba, which is basically China, in October. As the dollar rolled over, both emerging markets and Alibaba rallied. As the dollar strengthened, they've been weaker in recent weeks. And as the dollar rolls back over, both of these will get bid in a major way. Second group that's going to benefit from a weaker dollar is going to be biotech. Biotech will accelerate its slow recovery from last May's low as risk comes back into the market with a weaker dollar. So this sideways is going to now turn into a bid in our view. And more importantly than anything is with the Fed being out of the market, risk will come back. And finally, the third group that's going to benefit in a material way, which no one's talking about, is any multinational company with revenues abroad will increase earnings materially as the dollar weakens. Roughly 40% of the S&P 500 revenues are generated outside the United States. For example, Intel gets 82% of their revenues from outside the U.S., 3M gets 49% of their revenues from outside the U.S. PayPal gets about 47% of their revenues outside the U.S. VF Corp gets 45% of their revenues. Stanley Black & Decker gets about 45%. Baxter gets about 45% of their revenues outside the U.S. So it's not just the benefit of the currency translation. It's the benefit that they're selling outside with the weaker dollar. So exporting works well in that scenario. Now, number two, long-term treasuries, in this case we're looking at the 10-year note, will begin to get bid after a few weeks of heavy issuance following the debt deal. So they're going to have to play catch-up and issue a lot of bonds in the next week or two, so we're not expecting miracles in 24 hours. But after that is absorbed in the system, we think that you're going to see the longer end of the curve start to get bid. People are going to want to get ahead of the Fed meeting and certainly afterwards and say, wow, these high rates, we got to lock them in while we can. And you're going to see a huge bid in longer duration. And as a result of that, interest rate sensitive sectors will get bid. They trade in sync with the 10-year. I mean, you can even look right here. It's right there for you. Look at the 10-year note. And look at IYR, which is the REIT ETF. As the 10-year note rolled over and yields went up, REITs collapsed. And as rates stopped going up in September, October, you got a little bid, but until you see this start to recover, you're not going to see REITs recover. But we do think this is going to happen now, and that's why there's a huge opportunity in REITs. And all you need to do is ask anyone if they're interested in REITs right now, and when they tell you no, you know we're on the right track. Now, banks will also start to get bid again as their portfolio and loan book mark-to-market improves, reducing the need to raise capital. Funding costs will begin to moderate as deposit rates become more competitive to alternatives. So this trade that we talked about a few weeks ago in the hole started to recover a little bit, but we think it's just the beginning. So could we go back down and retest? We can always do that, you know, but when you look a year and a half out, you get a recovery to 60, 65 here. I mean, this is just going to be a monster trade. I think we've got 20, 25 strikes or something like that. So that'll be monstrous. Small caps will get bid as banks begin to recover. They've been a major laggard this year. You can see the exact same pattern basically as REITs. And when these get bid, that's a function of banks and smaller energy. That's going to be off to the races. So we like that. We think there's a lot of rotation that's going to happen under the surface, and these groups are going to start to participate. It's going to be a lot more than just five stocks. Those five stocks can keep going, but they'll probably go at a slower pace relative to the others that haven't gotten a bid yet, and we look forward to that happening. That's going to be very, very healthy for the market, because it means the market doesn't have to go up so dramatically, but there can be stocks underneath that can go up very dramatically in the interim. So retail sentiment is still fearful at 29% bullish. That's good. That means we continue to climb the wall of worry. Fear and greed didn't change week on week. That's a little better than neutral. Fear is thawing. And the active investment exposure is still very low at 59%. So they've got to play catch up. Earnings, communication services, they were revised for 2023. They were revised down 2%. For 2024, they were revised up 0.5%. There's still opportunity here. And that's the top 30 weights revisions in the last 60 days. Technology, XLK, top 30 weights have been revised up both for 2023 and for 2024. 1.28% for 2023, 1.1% for 2024. So all the recession callers are, you know, don't know what to do because they've been calling for a 20% drop in earnings, and earnings keep going up. So overall, we can, oh yeah, so we had another jump up from 246 to 247 for next year last week. So earnings continue to climb. Estimates continue to climb, and that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Consumer confidence came in a little bit better than expected, and now we're going to move into our Ask Me Anything questions. So, all right, first and foremost, we've got, love watching your weekly video cast and contrarian style of investing. This is from Swapnin Pravin. What are your thoughts on Allied Bank? Their net interest margin is still greater than 3%, and average maturity of their auto loan portfolio is less than 3 years. Thank you for helping us value guys stay the course. Best wishes. So I think I'm not in love with buying the subprime stuff right now. I think the prime stuff is cheap enough. When I can buy Bank of America or a basket of regional banks, down, why am I going to mess around with Ally when it's just dealing like predominantly with the subprime? I can see why you want to buy it, and this is probably going to work. Let's just take a quick look. Trading at less than 7x forward. Well, it's historically traded this low, okay. 5% dividend yield. Buying back a ton of stock. That's pretty interesting. Yeah, so they're an auto lender. I do think a lot of those used car loans are going to default. Customers, because the price is paid. I think people are going to walk away. Like, they overpaid for the cars at super high interest rates. I think you're going to see a lot of jingle mail and people just saying, have it. all yours. I would just look. I think you're right on this. I gotta be honest. I think this will work. I think it's okay, but size it accordingly. Just know what you're getting into. I mean, it's subprime lender, so this thing could go down to 15 before it goes back up to 40. But I do think a lot of the bad news is priced in, and I do see that the business continues to grow. So I think, and I like the capital responsibility. I mean, they're just buying in tons of stock. So there's not a lot to hate other than the businesses they're in right now. And if we don't have the recession and people keep their jobs, which is kind of our base case, even though the defaults on the used cars are going to go up with or without a recession, I think that's probably priced at these levels. So I think it's a good pick. I'm a pass, but I think it's a good pick. And just size it accordingly. Patrick Kungel. Hey, Tom. Hedge fund tips is a national treasure. Holy cow. National treasure. All right. When I share your channel with friends, I tell them HFT teaches you how to fish, which is a long-term skill set that anyone can develop because you've been so gracious, humble, and transparent. Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot to me. One, that you're sharing, and two, that that's the way that I behave, and it's a good reminder. Although in golf, I've been immensely humbled in the last week. After winning the first bracket of the match tournament at our club, I literally haven't been able to hit an iron in a week and change. Complete disaster. And went on the, you know, I've been trying my hardest to get my swing back and start puring balls again. And, in my efforts, I've ripped some muscles in my right rib cage because I've hit so many balls, that I'm going to have to rest for a few days and hopefully be in good shape for the second bracket. And hopefully my swing will come back. But humility is certainly top of mind in the last week as it relates to that. But I'm glad that it comes through in the podcast as well. Okay, one question. Richer, wiser, happier. Bill Miller mentions he no longer creates complex models for his decision-making process. In traditional sell-side and buy-side roles, is complex modeling all that useful? In your own approach, how much time do you typically spend cooking up financial models, if at all? Apologies if you covered it in a previous video cast. I have some catch-up. All the best, Patrick. So if you're entering the buy-side or sell-side, you have to know it. If you're in the buy-side or sell-side, you have to know it. After a couple decades in the business, you're going to have seen enough things and enough cycles that you'll still have your models, but you also have enough humility to understand that the forward projections are completely useless. And while you have them, you have to get price at a level that has such a margin of safety that if your models are 50% off, you still make money. And that's the value of models, is not getting models to say, you know, well, if it grew 5%, you know, if it grew cash flow 5% a year for the last 10 years, it's bound to grow 5% cash flow for the next 10 years. And then, but it's trading at fair value. And then if it only goes at 4%, you get a 30% impairment that never comes back. I'd be interested in that if the stock's down 50%. And then if I'm wrong and it only grows at 1%, I still make a ton of money on the double. So, learn it, master it, and then the better you get, the more you'll realize how and why and when they should be applied. Lewis, I am. Thanks for all you do. Any more books you recommend? I started and I'm almost done with The Greatest Trade and have thoroughly enjoyed it. I have a few that I've some that I've recommended, some I haven't. Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham, of course. All the Berkshire Hathaway annual letters and the partnership letters when he was running a hedge fund. Most people forget that had he not run a hedge fund for the first 15, 20 years of his career, we wouldn't know Warren Buffett. So although he tells everyone to index, if he had taken his own advice, he wouldn't exist today because he would have never gotten the capital to get control of Berkshire and then to have a free float machine that generated tons of leverage for him to basically invest in a broad swath of American business. And on leverage, cost-free leverage, because he had underwriting discipline, he compounded money faster than anyone else or most people in history through what was effectively massive leverage with the float. So the idea of don't use leverage and index, if he had followed those two bits of advice that he consistently gives, it's unlikely he would be anything close to a billionaire. He'd probably still be worth $50 million or whatever, but not $80 billion, that's for sure. Margin of safety, Klarman. I think Poor Charlie's Almanac is a worthwhile read. What I'm listening to right now is The Outsiders, which is about Teledyne. Like that one by Thorndike. That's really worthwhile. Quality Investing by Cunningham. He's a professor that compiles all the annual letters and makes sense of them. And then Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits by Fisher. So that should give you a few. And when you run through those, ask another AMA and I'll give you some more. Kayla Smith. Hi, Tom. Wonderful show. I make sure I watch every week. What are your thoughts on Target? It's down 20% over the tuck swimsuit controversy. Other than that, I can't find any other news or headwinds. I see retail stocks and discretionary spending have taken a hit, but I think it's mainly an overreaction of the boycott that hurt Target, which people will move on and forget. Secondly, what are your thoughts on Advanced Auto Parts? It took a massive haircut and is at 2012 levels. Thank you. Okay, well, I won't make any comments on whether a 1 or 2 year old needs clothes that are tuck friendly, but I will say, take a look at the stock. A friend of mine, Lydia Moynihan, is a reporter at the Post, and she called me about Bud with the Bud Light controversy. And I hadn't really spent much time on it because those are kind of dog stocks. And but I did the math, and you see all these huge numbers, like Bud Light sales are down 30% in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of did the analysis for her, and it wasn't the answer that was going to create a splashy headline, so I don't think it became a story. But the answer was that the U.S. sales, I think, were 30% of total, and Bud Light sales were down 20%. Anyway, the net effect of the drop in sales was 2% of global revenue because of the percentage of U.S. sales that were Bud Light and then the percentage of global sales that were Bud Light U.S. And it only came down to 2% of total revenues, and the stock was down more than 20%. And by the way, Bud Light had been declining since 2010. Volumes had dropped 30%. So they did this marketing campaign because it was a Hail Mary pass. They had nothing to lose because the brand was already in secular decline, because obviously everyone loves the silver bullet. I mean, who drinks Bud Light anyway? But leaving that aside, the point is that I think it was $53. I said, you know, honestly, as a value guy, whether I like the company or I don't like the company or whatever, I'd have to take a look at this thing in the low 50 or the high 40s, and I may not get a chance to do that. I won't, because they're kind of like, but they also, you know, they have Corona, they have Modelo, they have Stella, they have, you know, they've got 100 some odd brands. So Bud Light as a percent, U.S. Bud Light as a percentage of global sales. So when you separate the noise, if you just look at headlines, you'd be like, oh my God, Budweiser lost 30% of their sales. They're going to go out of business. This is never going to end. Nah, it's 2% of global sales, and it may or may not blow over, but that brand was toast anyway. I mean, it's a major part, but it was kind of in decline. So here's what's going to happen, ladies and gentlemen. Over the summer, you're going to see a ton of ads. Every single one of those ads is going to have American flags and Clydesdale horses and a can of Bud Light. And sooner or later, at the end of 3-4 months, half of the people will still be pissed off. The other half of the people will say, okay, they're trying to make amends, et cetera. And the game will go on. As it relates to Target, you know, the point I would make, you know, this has gotten so far above trend. And I think what's going to happen here, it's going to consolidate. It was trading at a meaningful multiple. So it's going to earn 8 times 2. So it's trading at 22 times. And its historic average multiple was 15 times. So, you know, I think you're just going to have to get a consolidation. And this thing's going to come back down to trend for a while. With or without tuck-friendly baby bloomers. I mean, this, you know, you can't make this stuff up. But leaving that aside, so I'm probably a pass on Target. I if I had to take a retailer, let's see if Walmart's come down enough. No. That's not for me. But Advanced Auto Parts, I think I said a few weeks ago, someone asked about Advanced Auto Parts, and I said, look, I think used cars are toast because the financing costs are too high, and people, there's 3 years of backlog for people wanting new cars, and the only way you're going to get a new car is dealers are going to fill their lots, inventories are going to go up, which we're already seeing, which helps Cooper Standard, by the way. And by the way, the April numbers came in at 16.1 million seasonally adjusted SAAR for April, which is well above trend. Expectations were 15.1 million for US at the beginning of the year. So we'll see if that trend persists, but that was super exciting to see. Compliments to my friend Zach via the Morgan Stanley research that he sends. So on the one hand, the average car on the road is record age, like 13.7 years. So these companies should do well. O'Reilly, let's take a look at O'Reilly. If it's come down, that's kind of best in class. So O'Reilly hasn't. So Advanced Auto Parts is probably not as good of an operator. I got to tell you, as much as I hate the used car market, and I think the whole game is going to be new cars for the next 24 months, this has come down enough where they did cut guidance. They did cut the dividend. If I had to be in auto parts retailers, this is the first one that I would be giving a shot. I think it's going to take a little while to bottom here, probably in the mid to low 60s. And there's still risk because they've just kind of thrown in the kitchen sink saying we're taking down guidance, we're cutting the dividend. So it's going to take time. But I'd be more interested in this one than any of the others. But the good news is, like I said a few weeks ago, I don't have to be in it, so I'm not. But if I did have to be in it, that would be one that I would take a look. So I think you're on the right track. I think both of these are going to take a little time. Target's not for me, and Advanced Auto Parts not for me at the moment. And I'm perfectly happy missing both of them if I'm wrong and they turn around faster than I expect. Jason Patel. Tom, am I missing any major U.S. companies in the below list that derive a substantial amount of their revenue out of China? Just put this table together to remind myself how much revenue comes out of China for various publicly traded U.S. companies whose share price and multiple gets the full benefit from the China revenue growth potential in their financials, yet somehow Baba shouldn't due to geopolitics. Somehow these companies are immune from the same concerns? I did this fairly quickly, so don't quote me on the below numbers. Just in Google searches, if I'm missing something, let me know. Frustrating to see the same arguments posted over and over again out there, and the argument doesn't apply to publicly traded U.S. companies with substantial revenue derived out of China. Apples to apples, it seems you should discount or back out the China revenue from these U.S. companies when thinking about share price if you are legitimately factoring in Taiwan geopolitics. And wouldn't the market would have already done this by now and hammered the share price of all these companies if geopolitics were a real concern at this juncture? I know your answer, just frustrating. Maybe there's a flaw in my thinking you could point out. Nope, your thinking's right. You just got to be patient, my man. If that markets are efficient, if that divergence didn't exist, there would be no opportunity. So every single thing we do is always created out of some level of irrationality in public prices that would never be accepted in the private markets. You know, I went through last year, if someone had offered you a 4-year payback period, Because when you back out the cash on Alibaba, it's $130 billion, you know, and they're generating $25 billion of free cash flow. They'll be generating $30 billion. 4-year payback period, you would take up the entire book subscription if it was a private deal. But here, you can't give it away now. But guess what's going to happen? In 3 years, the thing's going to be trading at 10 times the multiple that it's trading today. It's going to be irrational exuberance, and you can't give it away. And in the private markets, no one would do the deal because it would be too expensive. But in the public markets, people won't be able to get enough. And that's why I love the public markets, because it's a manic depressive, which you're going to learn in the first book recommendation I gave to that gentleman. Market's a manic depressive, and that's how we take advantage. You're completely logical and rational, Jason, and that's what creates the opportunities. You have to parse that in your mind, separate out the noise, and wait. And that's it. And that's the name of the game. So, Oz Smadja. Hi, Tom. First, I must say that your podcast has been a game changer for me. I've not only learned a ton, but also shared it with my friends, and they're loving it too. Thanks for the valuable content. I'm invested in CPS and have seen Moody's report that assigns a CAA3 rating to some of its debt, which is a low rating. At first, it was pretty strange to me because I've checked CPS. I'm pretty sure that it's going back on track. After further looking, I figured out the credit rating companies like Moody's have a different point of view from us value investors. For example, Moody's sees CPS refinancing as a distressed exchange. We see it as a success. My questions are, why does the credit rating of a company remain low even when it's showing signs of recovering, getting back on track? Because there's always a lag. Opinion follows trend. It's the same with the sell side equity analysts. They need to see more positive free cash flow and debt coverage before they do the upgrade. And by the time they do the upgrade, the stock will probably be at $25 or $30. And then it'll still be a junk bond. And then by the time the stock is at $60 or $70, then it'll have like a BAA rating or a triple B rating. And you'll be like, why is it a junk bond when the stock has gone up 7x? And because that's just the way it works. When valuing companies, do you take into account their credit rating? I do, but what I do is, you know, the first thing I did when I looked at CPS was I looked at the debt. And then I said, well, I'm taking equity risk anyway. I might as well have the upside of the equity. So I look at the debt to see what it's telling me about the equity. Sometimes you'll see the equity's down a ton and the debt hasn't even moved. And that's amazing. But in this case, that was a serious, look, they paid $80 million to get it done. And it tells you everything you need to know. They needed to pay $80 million to get it done. But now they have liquidity to 2027. The production is ramping up. So they'll be cash flow positive and then cash generative next year. They're targeting a double digit return on invested capital. And I have no doubt about management's ability to execute. I think they've executed extremely well through once in a 100-year circumstances. And I think they're going to out-execute everyone because of the cost that they've taken out and the discipline that they've shown during this exogenous event. And when those volumes come back, they're just going to mint money hand over fist, and they're going to double dip because of the new contracts that they've negotiated with the OEM. So that's how I think about that one. Jake Weinstein. Thomas, thanks for your insight, especially on BABA, which I'm a big believer in. As for New Flyer Industries. Okay, so I looked at New Flyer Industries. It's like a small cap, tiny stock in Canada that's an electric bus company that's been around for like 2-3 years. Hard pass. It reminds me of Workhorse, which if they're not out of business yet, they're on their way out. It's a hard business making electric cars or trucks or buses. That's going to be done. I mean, maybe they'll have a niche, but the problem they're going to run into is they're going to have to raise a lot of capital to keep the production going and the innovation going. And then it's unclear whether they'll have enough demand. So I'm going to say in a 5% rate environment, their ability to raise capital is going to be much more limited than it was 2 or 3 years ago when they started and money was free. And as such, no matter how good their short-term numbers look, my bet is they're toast, or if you're lucky, they're a takeout in coming years. But I don't know anyone who would buy that type of business. I think, having looked at it, I think what you're looking at makes sense. But having lived through enough cycles, I'm just telling you, for me, it's a pass. You could take a punt on it, and if you're lucky, maybe it's the next Tesla of buses, but I wouldn't hold my breath. But thank you for sending it in. Jack Zhang. Hey, Tom. Was wondering if you'd be interested in looking at PDD, Pinduoduo, for your AMA. It's one of the few platforms in China historically known for its agricultural products. However, lately it seems like a lot of poor people started to use it due to its promotional schemes. After you buy something on there, it gives you $5 to spend, $5 or it's gone. A lot of poor people in China, less than 200 a month. I initially thought they'd be profitable, but I was wrong. Lately it looks like, okay. So, I never take company and country risk, okay? I wanted emerging markets exposure. I wanted the biggest bang for my buck. I chose Alibaba. So PDD for me, number one, I've only got 3 or 4 years of economic data since they've been public, so it's not enough for me. So it's an immediate pass right there. Number two, I have enough country risk. So my premise going into Alibaba was, if Baba's toast, so is the Chinese Communist Party. So is China. There will never be another foreign dollar invested in China if Baba's gone. If Pinduoduo goes by the wayside, no one cares. So, for that reason, I wouldn't do it. Now, I'm going to take a quick look at the numbers, and I'm going to say, wow, the numbers are great. This looks perfect in every regard, and I still wouldn't touch it for those reasons, because it's China. So this is not like, in the U.S., I want to buy Coke, which is Alibaba, but I'll buy Pepsi instead because it's a little cheaper and everything will be okay. Like, Pinduoduo is like a good platform, but it's, not as good as Baba. I need the biggest and the best, and the biggest and the best is cheap enough that that's what I want to focus on right now. Pinduoduo, let's just pull up their numbers. They're going to be amazing, I'm sure. Just like Baba's, for that matter. But so growing like a weed, starting to make money, hockey sticking. But it's China. So I mean, you could definitely take a punt on this. Free cash flow generation is coming down though, but that's not true. No, it's growing. Now, I see your point, man. I mean, everything, there's nothing not to love here. But the other thing that was very important to me about Alibaba, and the reason I'm in Alibaba, is not for this retailing business, which is very competitive, and Taobao and Tmall is still the largest and has mind share in China, which is pretty valuable. Mind share, like Coca-Cola has mind share all around the world when it comes to consumer products. But my big bet on Alibaba is related to the cloud. That's the future growth. So I wouldn't just want to be in an online retailer, and that's all Pinduoduo is. So they're growing like a weed now. They probably will. If you want to take a punt on this, I would do it, but I would be barbelled. I'd have more weight in the bigger games like Baba or Tencent or something like that. And then some punts for the higher risk, higher reward, like Pinduoduo, maybe JD, stuff like that. But then if you start diversifying so much, you might as well just be in the K-Web. And they're all going to trade more or less the same. So, but I do think there is something special about Alibaba. I know people think Ant Financial's toast, but when that's ultimately public on its own, that may become interesting. That has zero value assigned to it now. Certainly, Freshippo, but AliCloud, we went over that last week, and I think that is a game changer, and Pinduoduo doesn't have anything like that. Brian M. asks, hey, there were no questions on Icon's IEP. Curious to hear your thoughts on the matter. Look, Icon's a legend. I will say two things on that. Number one, Icon's been going on TV for the last 5 years, bearish as hell, and touting that he had these, CDS on bonds and the whole thing, and puts on the S&P 500. And in the last month, we found out he lost more than half of his net worth, or $9 billion on his bearish bets over the last few years. So while he's been going on TV and saying that the world is coming to an end, he was putting his money where his mouth is, and it looks like about half of his money, and talk about a concentrated bet, and he lost $9 billion. So that's the bad news. The good news is the guy's compounded capital at a well above average rate for many, many years. The short seller, you know, he's in a lot of old industry stuff. He's got refiners, he's got energy stuff, so he might get a rebound here. The problem is the structure and how he uses the public shell to buy. It's too intermingled with his hedge fund. And then he controls the float and he uses leverage to pay out dividends. So it just seems, without having done a huge amount of research on the short report, it seems too self-dealing for my interest. And usually self-dealing setups are designed to screw the shareholder. And what I can see here is that the stock has done nothing for the shareholder in 17 years. It's the same price as it was in 2006. Now, I think he pays out a high dividend, so maybe you got maybe you got 5 or 6% a year doing that, but you did that with risk, and it's not your show. I mean, this reminds me of, yeah, so he's got a huge dividend on it. The other complaint in the short seller's report was that it was over leveraged, and I mean, Ackman, take it with a grain of salt because he got, you know, they had their disputes before, is basically saying that it has leverage like that reminds him of Archegos. I doubt Icahn would put himself in that type of situation. He's too smart for that, but he did admit with his $9 billion loss that he went against his own rules. So, for me, even though it's come down, even though it quote-unquote has a high dividend, it's a pass. It just seems too self-dealing. And as much as I think the guy is a great investor and I might look at individual names that he's in and be interested in those that are currently underperforming, I don't think I would be in this vehicle for those reasons. Like the guy, don't love the vehicle. Or respect the guy's performance, don't like the vehicle, and I'll leave it at that. So, with that said, we want to thank you for listening in this week. As always, we'll be back next week, same time, same place. In the meantime, make it a great one. Bye for now.